Hey, it's me again.
It's you again. I think it's Ben Kramer.
Yeah, good. How's your practice this week?
My practice has been steady and yeah, just waking up in the, I mean, it's been a little different in the sense of Asha's state is becoming more omnipresent. So getting coffee and food in her and oatmeal and eggs and steadying her. She fell this weekend. So actually it's been quite disrupted and more a matter, my practice has been more a matter of kind of taking care of Aurora and Asha and doing things upon the house. And so, but definitely spending time inside of the Gospels and St. John of the Cross and time, little bit of time on the cushion praying. And not very much yoga or physical practice this week. I've been sort of incorporating it into the roofing. So I'll do a, you know, I'll do like a little, you know, warrior pose or something or stretch in a certain way. So I try to incorporate some physical yoga into the finishing of the, this 40-foot long roof.
On the roof?
On the roof. I do try to do that with carpentry now. I almost have to constantly employ careful, you know, physical movements, going on my left knee, going on my right knee, just screwing and hammering, trying to be ambidextrous, taking my time, not breathing evenly is very, very hard. So you ask about the practice. I feel like the formal practice was probably pretty lukewarm and not much, but trying to make that, whatever you try to do in the morning, kind of spread throughout the day is often the kind of almost the meat and potatoes of it for a busy person like myself. So how about yourself?
What would you, it's so hard to,
it's really hard
to practice. Like, it's easier to have a thing, like a time of day when you think about spiritual things, spiritual matters and or God.
This is my spiritual time when I think about spiritual stuff.
Right, exactly. But to do that during the day, I mean, to say, as opposed to formal practice, it's like, I, you know, I can scarcely imagine a more formal practice than thinking about it while you're roofing or the like.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, that's, I thought that's where you were going. I thought you were going to, actually, I thought you were going to say the opposite. I was going to say, but wait a minute, maybe we need to, that's a lovely switch of thinking. Yeah, there is a sense in which when the busyness of the day, you know, it's beautiful. The prayer called sext, S-E-X-T, which would be after, you know, from 6 o'clock, six hours from 6 a.m. So the high noon one, God makes speed to save us. God makes speed to help us. There's this kind of, you're praying to ultimate reality and at high noon. It's like, whoa, I have not thought spiritual thoughts since I finished my coffee this morning. I've literally been running so it's like this interesting way of making it. It always
the very normal conundrum of a spiritual life. So one of the things that occurred to me early on in trying to have a spiritual life or something, I don't know, I mean, we're talking like 20 years ago or something, when I was just starting to study and see how much of my life I could devote to this thing, even though I had a job, would be waking up in the morning and thinking to myself, okay, I've learned all these beautiful new things that are these amazing intentions to keep with me throughout my day. And I would wake up in the morning and I would get to the office and I would think, okay, I'm going to think these thoughts. And then 5 o'clock rolls around and then it's just, I've just been on this conveyor belt through whatever my day was. And like you said, not one time did I think a spiritual thought. I just did whatever BS there was that day. And then shit, you know, what happened like that? I don't know, retaining the mind, keeping the mind, Drambach, right, Smriti, recalling the mind, Sati, mindfulness, as the kids call it nowadays.
Yeah, the smriti, the the memory, the remembrancing.
Yeah.
The remembering.
That's hard.
It so much depends upon the object or the ideal and the worldview, what one is, the you know, the deeper the conception of the ideal, then the easier it is for the mind to fall in love with it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Right.
Somehow it has to be service of other. Well, what was your focus? Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. You took care of this, that, and the other, but in the name of what, to what end, to what? And I don't know. And that in the downtimes, in the imprinting of the telos on the mind, the imprinting of the ideal, the imprinting of the archetype, the imprinting of the Buddha we want to be, the imagining ourselves in a place we are not, the recognition of the distance between the place which we would like to be and the place we are not, the recognition that we don't even know necessarily the nature of the place that we might want to be because our minds are faulty and can't even imagine such a place. And then it's a,
yeah.
But so much of it for me hinged upon the building of an ideal that steals my heart away, that allows that spiritual reality to be present in me and outside of me as I'm going through a plethora of responsibilities and things.
Right. Well, and turning the corner between disappointment in failing to live up to our ideals and excitement at the moments that we do live up to our ideals. The excitement makes it more fun. It creates this like positive reinforcement every time we remember that we want to remember something. But this expectation that we should somehow be some, well, and frankly, any damn thing other than exactly what we are, I think creates this sense of disappointment when we didn't live up to what we thought we were supposed to be. And then the end of the day rolls around, or we have a moment of remembering that's farther away from the last moment of remembering than we feel it, quote, should be, unquote. And now we're frustrated and we create a negative reinforcement when we remember this beautiful thing, which is a miracle. Then a miracle happens and we're sad because we're thinking about, we wished a miracle had come sooner, or we wished that we had had some other miracle than the miracle that we had, which would be remembering the whole time. But instead, you just remembered. You remembered that you want to carry love with you throughout the day. You remembered that you want to be aware of this presence with you throughout the day. You remember that you are growing. You remember to be patient with yourself, and then you're impatient because you forgot all day to be patient with yourself until this moment.
Yeah.
And
then there's the complexity of maybe trying to burst that way of thinking even more open potentially. And
why? How so?
Gratitude in being because of my creator. So it's more, it doesn't land on the self doing this and that so good. It more feels as if we've emptied ourselves so that the Holy Spirit or wisdom can dwell within us, so that the remembrance isn't so much a reflection. Maybe at a certain point in the spiritual path, there's a way in which the remembrance isn't necessarily a reflection on the good job I did. It might be that that doesn't come up as much. It would be more, oh, I hope that I was discreet enough to get, I got out of the way perhaps, and then this goodness could dwell. Now that of course,
a strong distinction between those two.
Oh, well,
it still sounds like you're saying I got out of the way enough, and then, but somehow that's not you doing it.
Well, it's a layer down for me. I experience a world where I try to recognize the goodness I've been doing without God, in a world where I recognize that goodness with God. And those are two different worldviews and experiences for me. So I guess I'm trying to highlight, talk about that. It's a difficult thing to talk about.
Yeah.
And it feels there's a deeper level of freedom and a lack of pressure on the self. The yoke is easier when we're not, when I'm not engaging in, at this point in my life, didn't I do well? Or something like that. Oh, that's good. You got up this morning, Kim. Didn't you do well to serve Asha the coffee? That was kind. And weren't you good to cook her the eggs again? And wasn't it nice of you to clean her kitchen? And wasn't it good that you got off the roof when she couldn't do the hose bib? And wasn't it good that you were by her side when you gave her the ski poles so that, and wasn't it good when you took her down to the tea? Like, it actually becomes rather on
not yours, isn't it good?
Oh, well, no, it is, but it's just, it becomes rather uninteresting in the sense that that perseveration at a certain point in the spiritual journey becomes an obstacle. That thought at a certain point to nakedness of spirit, or for me, the experience in my life.
That it's good, or the thought that I'm good?
The thought that I'm good, the thought that it's, as opposed to just this sort of flow of gooding, as opposed to, I don't know. I mean, perhaps this is not a useful avenue to go down. I'm seeing a distinction where you're not, and I really don't know how to talk about it. Actually, there's a sense in which I feel no yoga or no.
I mean,
there's the occupation of gratitude and grace that frees me from the a heavier, too well described doer, an excessively described reified doer who's done a damn good job, by Jove. And I'm just like, that's fine. And I think it's necessary to get out of self-disgust and self-hate. And it's necessary. I don't know if it's a thought that we want to carry all of our lives or practice in all of our lives. I still need to practice what you're talking about. But I have felt this other possibility. And I believe that we are saying something different. Where you're saying, well, it amounts to the same thing. You got empty enough to then have this thing, and it's as if maybe we are completely mistaking the nature of self. And so when that mistaken self is then complimenting that self that was mistaken while it did its good deed, perhaps even,
I mean, my feeling is that it also gets a little bit, I understand that you're attributing where credit is due in a different place. I'm not unaware that there's any distinction being drawn whatsoever. But I would say that, especially in so much as we're talking about a subconscious process, that to say that I am to evoke my will upon remembering is, of course, nonsensical. I don't have that. That's not a muscle that I can flex. I'm training a subconscious process, and to whether I rejoice that my mind worked in that way, that I wasn't a muscle that I flexed, or whether I rejoice that, so to speak, the dog brought me the newspaper, but I didn't, am I going to pet the dog or am I going to smack the dog with the newspaper? The danger is in being disappointed. The danger is in in my mind, in wishing that we could live up to something higher and then rejoicing. It's, am I necessarily thinking in those moments, oh, look, it came back. I rejoice in God's work. Not per se, right? Like I wouldn't use that vernacular, but at the same time, I am experiencing it like a grace. To say I did it is not exactly the point, because like, oh, good, it happened. And by rejoicing in this holy thing that has happened, it does seem that one makes themselves more predisposed to that thing occurring again. And especially, all the more so the contrary, to expect that I should be other than I am. And also assert some sort of agency that I do not seem to have. And so I think that in a way, like we're Yeah. We're both talking about rejecting agency.
I mean, of course, the remembrance of God, the more we come to love God and the mystery, the more it's the remembrance itself is pure joy. There's no like rejoicing. The very remembrance of God, of unity, of love, of interconnectedness, the very remembrance of any, and as our tapestry and understanding of the mystery of God grows, and which seems to like we understand less as we understand more, it becomes a joy in and of itself. The very remembrance is the joy. It's not so much. So there, much closer.
We're complicated beings, and we still manage somehow. We still have the capacity. When we remember love, we remember bliss. We remember our hearts filled with love and bliss from within and from without. We still have the capacity, as the complex beings that we are, to say, "Oh heck, I should have remembered this thing that was naturally joy earlier." And somehow of course, step on it, you know?
Yeah, and somehow step on it. There's also, though, I think, our understanding of our ideal has to be, I mean, much of the grace, I mean, much of the occupation of life is attending to grace. Gratitude is, it's an endless chain of events that got us to this podcast, sitting comfortably with some water and with each other. And so there's a way in which just being in your presence, I don't have to, for example, when I'm talking with you, struggle to remember the divine. Here we are. Now, it could be that our talk is pushing the divine away, or maybe our intentions are mixed and we have confusion around why we're engaging in this conversation. But there's a way for me that my very engagement with you is a I am in the act of remembering. And so that's a lovely thing. So I think this is also part of what spreads out into our week, hopefully, and helps us. It just keeps me a little more
constant. That's part of technique also. And I think that some of what we're talking about is technique. And this question of whether or not it's contradictory to discuss grace and technique in the same sentence. And it seems to me, and it seems to me that it seems to you that it's not contradictory, that it's a little bit mysterious, but not contradictory.
But I do want to push the poet and the artist, the mystic who falls in love with God, that there is a tech. When we fall in love with our mate, maybe for life, we take these vows and we build these marriages, and they just become just the major work of our life is this partnership, and we're when we fall in love with God, like more deeply than we do our wives, when we fall in love with this way, it to me, it's the thing that holds technique. It's the thing that seeks technique. If technique is sought without that, without the poet, the artist, the mystic, the dancer, the musician, the broad, like that kind of, and then my gosh, take the logician and take the metaphysician and think about method, but to me, what changed for me so profoundly was when we engaged in certain of the what are called the tantric practices in Buddhism together and the secret practices, I didn't fall in love with the ideal that was presented to me, and so the sadhanas, the practices, never took off. They never, whereas the milieu and the symbols in which I'm now dwelling inside of Mary and Jesus Christ, and it has lit. It's a love story before it is a technique, and all techniques are in obeisance to the love story.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's right. And I think that a marriage doesn't last a decade on the wind of the, and you know, the first flush infatuation, no matter how grand.
Really?
I think that, yeah, you know, it's just in. But then comes the, I mean, no part of me is denying the romance with the divine. And I think that's what you mean when
I'm not just saying romance. Oh, God, don't, let's not, I'm not just saying not at all just romance. No. I mean knowledge.
What do you mean? No, and I don't think you're saying that. And right,
okay. Sorry. So, I mean,
Something like just romance doesn't even, I mean, it's almost a,
or first flush or something like that. No, it's like
but to make delimiters around a word like romance that's meant to be, you know, watery shape. What would it mean to say just romance? I agree that you gotta, I don't know, this is something I've, you know, I often try to sell things to my students in a yoga class or in a yoga setting that I'm trying to sell to me. But that I've, you know, in some cases I've been working on for a long time, which is that I don't believe you can, here, I'm really going to reduce the romance down to something overly simplistic, but I'm going to try and get away with it. I don't believe that you can experience the long-term results of a practice. The true long-term results of a practice are very hard, nearing impossible to partake of if you don't like the practice. If you don't like it, right? I'm reducing it now to like to some degree. And there are many shades of like, and...
But you said like the practice, the practice.
I am. Like,
Yeah.
We can say what the practice is. It's, you know, the mind. We could say it's returning the mind to God, or we could say it's the mind returning to God.
But I'm referring not to the love or liking of the practice, but what the practice is aimed to. I'm referring to
the... I'm saying that I don't believe that you can divorce the practice from that. I'm not saying it's the act of bringing the mind back again and again. That's not what's interesting, you know, unless it is, and then cool. But we're talking about the practice of bringing the mind back again and again to love. That's lovely. You know, so I'm not divorcing the two. I'm still talking about a relationship with love.
I didn't think that you were.
Mm-hmm. So spending time with love is the practice, becoming more and more filled with love, working towards the experience of experiencing more and more love. Is it the experience of love that is the practice, or is it the fruit of the practice? I mean, yes, the answer is yes, of course. Of course it's yes. And and to come, as you say, the reward itself is being in the presence of love, is experiencing the presence of love. Yes. And I still need to be reminded that sometime when I come back, when I'm rusty, when I've been off the cushion too long. We were talking about in a class recently, the three elements of practice in the Yoga Sutra. You should do it for a long time. You should do it correctly for a long time without gaps. Satkara sevito. Oh, I'm sorry. Dirghakala nirantarya satkara. A long time without gaps, correctly. And I can honestly say I have finally sort of achieved one of them. I've done it for a long time with lots of gaps and probably mostly badly, but something has come by having done it a long time. Having achieved one of these elements, and yet I also have those gaps when I'm away for a little while and I come back and I'm like, well, shit, it took me longer for the mind to come back to love. That's sort of disappointing because I want to be in line with love. I long to be in line with love, and that's a precious attitude, to long to be in line with love. But
yes.
But you can't, know that at the same moment. You can't know at the same moment how dearly you long to be in line with love without being to some meaningful extent in line with love. And you're still capable of forgetting that even in that moment.
Yeah.
I am. One is, I think, because I am a one.
It's strange that we don't go out of being when we lose the remembrance of love. It's amazing that we even continue to be. And so I want to desperately speak of the other and the beloved and relationship and distinguishing between the practice and what the practice aims towards.
What do you mean that we should go out of existence or something?
I don't know.
Because that is
love potentially is the you know, the self-emptying love of the creator in love. Like this love might be the source of being in a sense. And the idea that you can just continue to be without somehow. And so there must be some way perhaps in which the human soul is engaged in some sort of, there's some subconscious remembrancing always going on, even maybe in every action is like from evil to killing to it's like a twisted love. It's coming out of this root of will and intellect and being and this complexity of being. But perhaps, you know, and I guess I just was saying, what do I mean? I don't know what I mean by saying it's amazing that we still exist when we stop loving. But
I think my sense of knowing you and having had conversations with you over the years is. It has to do with the ideal of identifying love as ultimate reality. But if love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality, if it's a little more complicated than just that.
Well, that's sort of what I've been speaking.
But then we could be in and out of touch with it. We wouldn't. There's no reason that.
Oh, of course. I wasn't really making a scientific statement or a spiritually scientific and accurate. That was more like a John Donne poetic, like utterance. You know, how is it that we even continue to exist when we forget love? You know, it was just a more of a, more like of a jazz lick than a logical lick.
I think it's in keeping with jazz to respond to jazz with logic just as much as it's in keeping with jazz to respond to logic with jazz.
Yeah, jazz is probably the wrong. Suffice to say, I wasn't thinking of it as some sort of a, but it just kind of a inspire, like a little weird insight into God for me. Because to me, we're held in being by love, which goes on loving whether I'm aware of it or not. And it is very much not me. Oh, I can participate in it. I am made in the image of that love, but my image is contorted and I can't look into the mirror of that love and see love. I see other.
Affirmatives are so much safer to speak than negatives. And which is not to say that there aren't negatives, but I find in a lot of these things, like, to speak about love as ever present or to speak about love as something that exists outside of me is somehow different than saying it is, that it is not me.
Well, that's why I was just saying we're made in the image, but we need to make it like it. We're it's in our, absolutely, right there. Yeah,
say a thing is one and a thing is two, as opposed to say, like, that seems okay if I say that that I am a thing and I am also two things and I am also three things, that all those things. But as soon as I say I am not one thing or I am not three things, it seems to me I've suddenly gotten into trouble. That part of the understanding that, that perspective, that the wide lens upon reality yields, is that things that seem to be contradictory are not contradictory. Mm. And somehow, and maybe this is too vague, you know, I mean, I don't know if you give me enough credit for being, you know, poetic sometimes when I, just because I'm using complete sentences, but I have this feeling that, that the affirmations are much safer somehow. And so I'm loath to say that, right, that it is not me, that love is
but
not
that's,
me.
But that's not what I was saying, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but
I wasn't. I was saying there's, you know, in, let's just say, using a Christian context, made in the image of God, there's a sense in which everything we do is coming out of love. It's often without remembrance and very twisted. So the notion of the source being understood by a perverted image, I can't look and see, but I am made in the image of God. The issue is to become like that, to make the image like. So the work is exactly, so you're both not it and it. You're, there's a way in, well, how not it? Well, I didn't remember for the last 3 hours until my, or how not it? Like, well, I've just been cruel to somebody. That doesn't mean that was twisted love, as opposed to cruelty, which is an interesting way to look at twisted. It's a very compassionate way, actually, to look at evil and the problem of theodicy, or the problem of suffering and evil and death in the world, as an image that's been twisted. Nonetheless, an image, and yes, oh yes, part and parcel of God, but also not at all. Please, like, you're not even, we're like, so recognizing we're dust and ash and nothing, but also recognizing we're children of love, like, both with pretty, I mean, I don't know, bro, like, with pretty full on both, at least my experience of myself, I don't know. And then the question becomes, well, what's helpful? Is it, you know, the question becomes like, Ben's like, so what extent does focusing on my death and on my contingent nature and upon my limitedness and upon my brokenness, to what extent is that a springboard into divine love? And
is that contextual, right? I mean, I think it depends on, you know, if it's, yeah, Wednesday or Thursday, or this Wednesday or this Thursday, or, you know, when we, you know, learned about, vows and trying to remember, trying to see ourselves as divine in this tantric context, at the same time as learning about, keeping our vows, and that if we had a healthy amount of safe doubt, we could never fully keep our vows because we would never commit the sin of believing that our mistakes were correct, and that somehow compounds the sin. To think that your mistake is actually a good thing compounds the sin. But if you don't overestimate yourself, then you don't have the risk of that, because you think, well, if you think, always think I'm kind of a schmuck, then you can't think, you can't fully commit a breakage of a vow in the sense of thinking, you know, what I do is so great. But at the same time, you're learning this practice of seeing yourself in a divine way. And so how do the two make nice? And I ask, I mean, this is like my moment of interrupting in class. Yeah. Like, well, wait a sec. You told us this and you told us this, and like how, and, you know, the Lama said, you're going to have to figure it out. You're going to have to figure out when you need one or the other. Like, sometimes you're going to need one and sometimes you're going to need the other. Sometimes you're going to have to ramp up one and sometimes you're going to have to ramp down one. And so, yeah, of course there's utility to so many of these practices. And there are probably, see, this is interesting. I don't know, but are there people who need to chastise themselves or be punitive on, you know, when they remember the object. I'm not so sure about that. You know, I have a teacher, my kid has a new teacher, and the teacher, you know, said that, you know, my kid, you know, he's adjusting to kindergarten and it's hard. And she sat him in the front row and she said, if you cry, then you have to go to the back row. And she told us that. And we said, geez, you know, I don't know that he, I don't know that he responds as well to that. I think he responds really well to positive reinforcement. Yeah. And, and she said, no problem. Thanks. You know, thanks for telling me, how it is with your kid. And, you know, all kids are different, and some of the kids I think would react better to that. And, to what? To, you know, to threats? I'm not sure. I've wondered, there's this, thing they say about,
mm-hmm. Yeah, go on. Yeah. The thing they say about what?
No, just it's fine, but just about Tibetans that somehow that the Dalai Lama didn't know what low self-esteem was or something until he, you know, he was hearing some, you know, Westerners at a conference talking about it and describing low self-esteem, and he was like, "Who are these people? Like, are they okay? Are they like, and do they take medication? Or like, where are they?" You know, what's their deal? Or, you know, and the commentators were like, you know, your holiness, it's, we're talking about us, you know? And he was like, oh, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. And, but I don't know, maybe.
Though the healthy recognition of death and that you're dust and ash is precisely what healthy self-esteem is built on, because there's a realism in the Tibetan view. So it's a strange thing when I suggest that I am not God. It's not, mm-hmm. It's actually an act of great self-distrust and proper healthy self-love, because I realize I to start where I am is the only place. And I still through faith feel held in mercy and love within that fully broken place. So I I like that you went to, you know, the vision of oneself as the lowest in the room and the vision of oneself as a deity. The interesting thing about the vision of oneself as a divine being is that we're encouraged to see everybody else as divine. And when we're visioning ourselves as the lowest, we're encouraged just because it's so easy to exaggerate our own place in terms of how many years we have. It's so easy to just get caught in the mechanism and power of worldly life and the whole, and just the pulling, seeing oneself as lowest is just this, if understood right, I think could be quite a glorious practice. And in fact, is the basis for then when you're seeing yourself as divine, you see everyone else as, in a sense, not more divine, but as the necessary components of being that complete your own divinity. So there's a sense in which even in the practice of Ngangyo, or seeing yourself, or divine pride, or seeing oneself in a divine way, or theosis in Greek Orthodox talk, or becoming like God, the image in Catholic talk, that whole process is actually an incredibly humble one. It actually takes incredible humility to drop the stories we have about ourselves and others and see the world as divine. It actually takes a lot of, at least it takes a sort of nakedness of spirit and a kind of emptying of what we think and how we think things are going to at least engage in, you know, some holy paranoia, right? Some like, as Geshe La once said, you know, some sacred, because there is a sense in which when you're practicing Ngangyal, you almost see that everything else is even not more divine, but you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like I do.
I guess I'm struggling a little bit thinking about how, I'm struggling with the same question that I asked, you know, all those years ago or something, because I still some of my clearest moments of humility are not pleasant. Like it's powerful. It's useful. It's helpful. The behavior that I tend to enact in times when I'm feeling some of that most profound humility tends to be more in line with how I would like to see myself behave.
Well, said.
But it's not always a real nice feeling.
No. The cross leads to the risen life. It's the doorway. It is not always pleasant at all. Although I do think that there are, in line with what you bring up so wonderfully so often, which is, well, what would be the practices that bring about that state? And I do believe there's a way we can talk about embracing the natural day-to-day sufferings that come up so that what became sufferings really are joy, that we actually run to the letting go of our own needs and run to the something that needs doing. And when one just runs in a moment like that to whatever, it feels like everything rushes to you. There's no fear of missing out. It's just all is given when in any given peculiarity or singularity or moment or specific event, if it's done with this abandon of, so that the risen life and the humble life, the Ngagyal, the divine pride and the humility, they're just opposite sides of the same coin, because as soon as you go to the depths of humility, you're pulled into heaven by God. I mean, you can't, the way up is down. In Christianity, the way up is down, and everything's upside down. It's all backwards, the ascending and descending ladder of Jacob. What's going on there? And what about these songs of degrees in the Psalms, these degrees, the song of ascents? And then you read this great ascent, and it has to do with like putting your head on the ground and it's like, you know, wiping the mirror of your heart with the dust of your guru's feet. And then so they seem so like almost like karma and emptiness, we were described as being the opposite sides of the same coin. It seems that humility and this other state we're talking about seem to be so deeply intertwined.
Well, and don't we all sort of, you know, fantasize in the spiritual game, so to speak, about this this state in which there is a steady drumbeat of the blissful awareness of the divine and the presence of love and that confidence. Yeah. That comes with that, but
that confidence, that's well said.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well,
yeah, divine confidence. It's very confident. It's well said.
Yeah, but then humility feels, you know, in my general experience, like exactly the opposite of confidence.
But don't you feel most confident when you're humble and emptied out? Like,
no.
There's like, because you're like, oh, now I'm being careful. I'm attending to the way of humility and love. Like you just said, but isn't there
like
a certain.
I'm less likely to do something. I feel.
Oh, yeah, it's a little negative, isn't it?
I'm less likely to do the profoundly dumb thing. Right. Yeah, right. Because I'm just so aware of my capacity or better yet tendency to commit that grand boo-boo. But at the same time, it's not, you know, to call that sensation confidence is a little bit.
Then maybe
from a poetic standpoint, it sure feels wrong.
By the way, I see you as saying poetic things quite often, and I just was trying to. And that little thing earlier, I was just trying to let you know I wasn't trying to make a sort of truth statement. It was just more of a kind of flew out from my heart.
I'm letting you know that I believe that responding to a flit out from your heart with something that analyzes it from a linear perspective as a truth statement or not is still a flit out from the heart sort of poetic thing to do.
Oh, okay. Well, fair. I can go with you there. But the I would say that there's humiliation and there's the ignominy, there's the desecration that is the cross. So there's an aspect to being that is humiliation. What often is born on the wings of humiliation, the humiliation of Peter or the apostles, the humiliation of turning your back on love. Well, now that can lead to then a sober humility and a sober awareness of one's own depravity and one's own situation precisely. And that humility is really the understanding of who we are. It's not it's and that's not it actually feeds self-esteem, because if I'm basing who I think I am on something someone else wants me to be, or what I thought someone else wants me to be, or what I thought society wanted to me, or maybe I wasn't the son my mother and I wanted me to be and the son my father wanted, and I'm basing it on all these which help to form who I am, because I try to imagine, well, what are the ideals they would like to see in me that I'm not projecting for them? And you go through this whole process, right? And what you
Yeah.
we have to find, I don't know, there's a
And
way in which we.
I can see the the sense or the logic or the appeal, and I don't mean to reduce it to those, but in the sense of otherness, if we are filled with a sense of divine spirit, to retain a sense of otherness about that spirit would help us to maintain a humility in the presence of that spirit. I
Yeah.
don't know that
Where
it's helpful.
were you when I painted the dew upon the first morning grass, or the grass that has always been? Where were you when I painted the clouds in the sky and let them rain upon? Where were you? Like
Well,
this, that doesn't mean
but I
that.
mean to say, to walk filled with a sense of divinity, filled with a sense of love, to have my heart overflowing with beauty and grace and power, and love and love, and to rejoice in the presence of that sensation, to be glad for that sensation, to be glad for its availability to me and those around me, which is expressing itself through this body or this mind as a nexus, and still to have the capacity to say, that is not me. And still to say, that is not, it is not I that is acting in that way. This is.
Probably the more empty a person gets of false narratives and boo-boos and obstacles, I think probably we become more aware that we're God, or we become divine. I think probably that is a thing that happens. Although I do believe in the earthly life, what's stressed is this profound sense of both of not being that, and how important that is, and also, but to an understanding to what extent we are that, I don't know. But for me, it does come down to a very non-abstract relationship with Christ, with God through Christ. With it comes down to a very, very, it's not conc well, concrete is the, it's like, it's
Well,
whatever.
right. And when I say, okay, when I quote, right, the great teacher in saying, in pretending to correct from love is ultimate reality to love is somehow the key that unlocks the door that leads to ultimate reality, it sounds like I'm being more precise, doesn't it? But I don't know exactly what the fuck that means.
But you do have some ideas about ultimate reality, and they might be very different from Martin Luther King's, that's for sure.
Oh, I mean, it's for sure that they might. And
It's for sure that they might, yeah, and they probably are.
But I'm making a nod to the poetic sensibility of offering that it's complex. See, I'm not saying, look, you know, I'm not responding to you with certainty. You're like, no, you have to, because this is exactly the way of phrasing.
Oh, I didn't think that. Yeah, but yeah, thank you.
I don't know what it means.
I don't think we could engage in this podcast if we didn't have this going on. I have to say,
something about this, like, I don't know, oblique, coming at it from oblique angles, coming at the divine from oblique angles. It's like looking at a nebula in the sky. It's the damnedest thing. You somehow can't see it as well if you look straight at it. I don't know what the deal is. You look at the Orion Nebula, you look at these dusty patches in the sky, the Andromeda Galaxy, and somehow you're like, I can't see it. I'm looking right at the right spot. But you look a little off to the center, and there it is in the periphery. And they're like, oh, I found it. And then you try to look right at it, and that's not quite the way to see it.
Oh, it's like Genesis and Moses, and dares not look into the face, but knows.
It just doesn't work. You just, for some reason, you have to be coy.
Well, you get cooked, I guess. You get cooked. God says you die if you look me in the eye. You're dead. You ain't no more. That's the thing you can't.
And I'm sure there's something about rods and cones or something like that. But spiritual rods and cones.
Your poetic metaphors are wonderful.
Still rooted in science. for the limited amount that I know about science at all. You know, I mean, science is also just another church to me. I don't know, you know, how the high priests in their laboratories do the work that they do. I stand before them and marvel at it, and I have this faith in them as they've shown me that, you know, as much of the depth of the incantations as they have the capacity to show someone with my limited vision. I marvel at the elegance of the structures created through these incantations of scientific method. And
we've inherited it. We scientific method, you know, in the West came out of a lot of the monasticism, and a lot of the monks were scientists. So there was a lot of the first scientists were monks. And it's just this extraordinary, you know, Francis Bacon, look at Roger Bacon, look at, not Francis, but Roger Bacon. Just unbelievable. How to say, like, taking scientific method and the Aristotelian method, those are used in the spiritual life. You know, these methods are used. And so no problem. I mean, you say you're not a scientist, but I would say you're definitely a scientist of spirituality. And we use some scientific method, don't you feel? Maybe we don't get control groups and masses, but don't you feel there's some kind of scientific method in what we're discussing, or maybe not?
I do. I mean, I believe that everything we're talking about is always is
open a question. Analysis.
Oh, I'm just saying a question of modes of arriving at truth and what we can do with the tools in our hand once we hold truth in our hand. And I don't believe that good religion, or if we want to use whatever the platitude of calling it spirituality instead of religion, or which seems to include, you know, religions that don't accept a distinct entity called a spirit, somehow, you know, are especially lumped in there, and science, that these, you know, that good Christianity and good Buddhism and good mathematics and good biology, good virology or epidemiology, and good God bless them, they would reject it, but the Church of Satan and all the work they seem to be trying to do today, and the atheists, and you're doing all of them. If you're doing all of them well, then they should arrive at the same place, because my uniform experience has convinced me that there is no other God than truth, which is also a poeticism that I'm stealing from
from Gandhiji.
A great master.
Yeah, Gandhiji and Martin Luther, we're doing good.
Yeah, right. And that sounds like I'm moving into the realm of precision when I assert, when I evoke the deity truth, when I speak the bija mantra. Right, truth.
such as
referring to a much larger body of thought that I this is my right. As much as I reject the empty platitudes of empty or lazy ecumenicism, it is also what I seek. But I want to get there the hard. I want to get there honestly. I want to get there the hard way, and I want to get there through acceptance and self-critique. And
we can only get there the hard way. I don't know. Although there is a way in which the yoke is easy, and there's a way in which the yoke or the yoga is difficult. Mm-hmm. There's a way in which it's both, and I do believe in tempering the instrument of the human temple, the human body. And soul and mind, spirit, that both are required. So as we've talked today, it seems like we're maybe not talking about a middle way or even a stoicism that finds a balance, or perhaps we're talking about a balance that comes from, you know, the extremes of theosis or imagining oneself in a very beautiful way, that would be a very good thing to meditate on and think about, but then also having trying to gain a realistic sense of one's, you know, upcoming death and the impermanence, and so holding these and then that they feed each other in some way.
I believe that quality science can be used to measure quality mysticism, and quality logic can be used to measure quality poeticism, and quality poeticism can be used to measure quality rationale. If done well, that we can measure these things up against one another, that they are different formulations to describe the same reality, and that there's a way of threading a conversation between all of these different modes that is deep and revealing of truth and not lazy and accepts when to do the work and when to let go of work.
Yeah.
When to flex the muscle and when to relax the muscle. And that so many of these things are necessary that, you know, though I'm loath to say all of these things are necessary, because, you know,
maybe some things are not. And it doesn't mean that there's suddenly not such a thing as misreligion, you know, misanthropic attempts at
at
goodness and bad science and bad rationale. And
exaggerating and in the light of our talk, because it's a slightly different subject from where we started, in light of the talk, which is where I was headed, is just you know praying that we might use the, you know, humiliation and humility needs to be tempered by recognizing the ways in which we are in fact love, and so that there is a temperance, but not necessarily by finding some tepid middle way, but rather living between the extremes of, you know, annihilation and resurrection. It just feels part of human life.
It's not exactly not what we started our conversation with.
Not at all. I just wanted to bring it back to that, you know.
It's an attempt to dwell within the divine and stay there. And what does it take to stay there? And whether you want to use that word or not, you know, whether a scientist may not want to use the word divine, but I think they like the word awe. To stand in awe of the vastness of the mysteries that may be, you know, revealable or reducible by a math that they themselves can't achieve, but that they believe that there is some crystalline math that they're ever, you know, building upon or arriving at depths. And it does seem to point to something infinite, but but that it doesn't mean that we couldn't construct a conceptual lattice which both contains the infinite and yet is
woefully short of it. Woefully short of it. Woefully not even close. Not even within the ballpark of the reality of God. Not even in the fuck. Not even like that goes for human. That goes for science. That goes for everything we've spoken about. Science, theology, every effort, like a speck of the reality that is to come, which I believe when we do are able to look into the light directly without being burnt. There are no words and there are no more. The argument is over. There is an end. There is an end to, I believe in that moment, there's something that happens that cannot be put into words. It just cannot. And in the, what I would say would be the deepest mystics or seers, they write words, they speak, and they had students, and they shared the gospel. But in the last analysis, except for Jay Tsongkhapa, maybe, in the last analysis, I cannot describe to you the reality that I experience. I cannot actually describe to you, but I will try. And
among the things that would make it impossible to describe such a thing would be if there were no such thing as a last analysis. And even if man were capable of crafting a mirror, that somehow he could point at another mirror, he could never plumb the depths of what he had created. That somehow it would have sprung from his heart, and at the same time, it would be vastly beyond anything he could wholly or completely describe to another.
Human being, not capable of such a thing. Human being.
Of describing wholly. Even anything that we could ascribe to ourselves as creating, which is not to say that you couldn't, because at the same time, to speak the word one is a whole. It is a whole description of everything that it subsumes, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's lovely.
Cool, dude. Well, thank you, man. I do like spending these times with you.
Back at you, bro.
Cool. Well, have a lovely day. I'll talk to you very soon.
Keep me in your prayers, and so that I can stay more in prayer, and I'll try to do the same. I actually think it works, and so it's pretty full on right now, and death is sweet. Death is a great teacher. It's a crown on our lives. It really is. It's the crown on the whole thing. Anyway,
that's beautiful. Well, I'll spend a little time thinking more about that. Yeah.
Send me your prayers.
I will. I do. I love you, dude.
I love your family. Bye, buddy.
Thank you, man. You too.